Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to be taking a look at some summer gardening problems. Do you have any? Almost everybody, it seems, has at least one. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, one of our guests. Lisa, good to see you.
You too.
And Brian Huddleston. Brian, hello.
Hello.
Dr. Death directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the UW Department of Plant Pathology. So, do you need some help diagnosing a disease on your plants? Maybe you have a pest problem? Call in. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, we've already gotten an email from Josh in Eau Claire. And this is he came across this growing in his yard. And what it looks like to me is a carrot, an orange carrot with some gray crappy stuff right at its tip. He mowed Wednesday and it wasn't there. It just popped up since Wednesday. He's never seen anything like it before. And it is pretty cool looking.
Yeah, I think it's very cool.
Looks like a carrot.
It's actually what's called a stinkhorn. And this particular one is called an elegant stinkhorn. And these are types of fungi. These are basically mushroom-like structures, but there are a wide range of these. They have sort of a look of a certain part of the male anatomy, let me put it that way. And some of the other ones really look like that particular part of the male anatomy. But this one is bright orange. The grayish material that you're seeing at the tip is sporulation of the fungus.
Oh.
And they're called stinkhorns because they usually stink. They're pretty fetid, and that odor attracts things like flies or beetles that will pick up the spores and then move them around. So
you really can tell when you've got them.
Yes, you can smell them. You definitely can. And my favorite vacation ever was going to Disney World and staying at a resort where there were three different types of stinkhorns all fruiting at the same time on property. So I was in plant pathologist heaven.
Well, is that one of the disease? It's not really a disease.
It's not a disease-causing organism, no. And actually, if you're ever digging in your garden, you may find these. They'll look like little potatoes or maybe eggs in the soil.
Yeah.
And if you cut across those, you'll see the sort of the start of these little structures inside. They're actually the start of these stinkhorn fungi.
So what are the diseases that we're...
Everything under the sun, quite frankly. It's been so wet this year and following another wet year last year. Everything was just primed for all kinds of fungal diseases, all kinds of bacterial diseases, just tons of what's called anthracnose. Yeah, anthracnose on woody ornamentals like maples and ash and oak trees and root rots and a variety of vegetable diseases. We've been seeing downy mildews and all kinds of fruit rots and leaf spots. So it's been very busy in the clinic.
Well, we have a number of callers online. There's still a line open at 1-800-642-1234, but let's take a few calls and see what's on people's minds. Jill in Waupun, it's your turn. Hi, Jill. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I have a question about an ash tree. It looked this spring like it was dead. There's a lot of dead-looking branches on it, but now there's all kinds of suckers coming up on the lower part of the branches. Is this tree... Am I going to be able to keep it, or is it beyond hope?
Oh, it's
probably beyond. Yeah,
beyond hope.
Sorry to say that. Probably that's a classic sign of infestation by emerald ash borer. And just to let you know, dead or dying ash trees can be unstable, so I would get it removed as quickly as possible. They do tend to shatter and drop branches and things like that. So particularly if it's a big tree, it could actually be a hazard. But when the emerald ash borer first starts, it attacks the top of the canopy and you start to see dieback in the canopy, and then it progresses. Usually you're going to see a lot of flecking in the bark as well from woodpeckers. And then, you know, you just get progressive dieback. Often you'll get these epicormic sprouts from the base. Sometimes the bark will peel off. But that sounds pretty
bad. Yeah, it's pretty
bad.
What about the shoots that are coming up around the base?
Yeah, that's the tree's reaction to the stress. It's trying to save itself. But since, you know, the ash borer is so widespread, it'll just get nailed again. So yeah. I would take it out.
And people, I think municipalities are even asking people, aren't they, to get rid of their...
There are some municipalities where they will require you to remove it, particularly if it's over like a city sidewalk or something.
Yeah.
But there are also other municipalities that are offering options for homeowners to treat their trees to save them. So there are fungicide treatments that can be used for this particular insect.
Not fungicide, but
insecticide. Sorry, my apology. My brain's in the wrong place. Insecticide.
Yeah, it would have to be less than 30% dieback for that to work. So, unfortunately, I'm sorry, yours is past that.
Yeah, in your case, Jill, I'm sorry, but there's probably no hope.
On that cheerful note.
Yeah, Jill, did that help?
It did help. I just wanted to get an educated opinion. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Well, Cheryl in Berlin has something different. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I'd like to know what is causing blossom end rot on most of my tomatoes this year.
Oh,
yeah,
boy.
So it's the bottom end of the fruit opposite where it attaches to the plant that's rotting. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's calcium deficiency in the plant. We see this quite often. And there are certain varieties that tend to be more prone to that. So if you're growing sort of Roma tomatoes, the kind of pear-shaped tomatoes, oftentimes those are more sensitive or susceptible to this. And oftentimes it's not necessarily that there isn't enough calcium in the soil, although that can be the case. Sometimes if we have a drier summer, I don't know, let's see, where are you from? You're in Berlin, so probably not the case. But sometimes if it's dry, if you're not watering routinely and kind of keeping even moisture, the plants have difficulty taking the calcium up. So what you may want to do is check your soil, have your soil check for calcium, send it off to a soil testing lab. We have one that's a UW facility that's up in Marshfield, and you can get information from your county extension office about where to send the sample, have them check for calcium levels. Although, again, I would be a little bit surprised if that were a problem, given that we have limestone as our bedrock here in the state. We tend to have plenty of calcium. But if that's not a problem, you may want to try a different variety that has fewer problems, particularly if you're growing the Roma varieties. Again, those tend to be a little bit more prone.
Are you growing them in pots or in the ground?
In the ground.
Okay. Yeah. Are you using like mulch or anything to keep the moisture in? Not that that's been a big problem.
A big problem, particularly in that area.
There was a dry spell.
Yeah, there has. Yeah. In some areas of the state, yeah, it's very dry.
It's been very dry. What I usually tell folks is to up the water, if we're not getting a lot of rain, is to up the watering, particularly as the plants go into flowering and fruiting, because they require more water at that time, and you definitely need that water to get the calcium into the plants and to the fruits.
Yeah, I'm thinking a watering issue.
Yeah,
myself as well. So there you go. And you ever cut the ends off and eat the tomato?
We technically are not allowed to recommend that, and I wouldn't, because those are considered blemished fruits, and we don't recommend eating any sort of blemished fruits. Yeah, because what's growing in that decayed material is probably not a human pathogen, but you don't really know that for certain. So it's best just to throw those fruits away.
Thanks, Cheryl, for calling. Chris in Washburn has an issue with his tomatoes, too, I think. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Another tomato question. So I've been growing tomatoes for quite a long time up here in Washburn. And recently, in the last couple of years, I've gotten my leaves all of a sudden get these like brown, blackish spots on them. And then it just spreads throughout the plant, and the leaves start to turn yellow and die off. And then I definitely start to see those blemishes on the fruit, and just wondering what might be causing that.
If you're seeing blemishes on the fruit, then it's most likely you're dealing with a bacterial disease of some kind. And you may have initially brought that in on, if you're growing the plants from seed, you could have gotten a seed lot that is contaminated with the bacterium. If you're buying transplants, sometimes the transplants can harbor the bacterium. You won't see any symptoms initially, but as the plants age and mature, then you'll start to see those leaf symptoms and fruit symptoms. There's not a lot you can do about it at this point in the season. What I would do for next year would be definitely move your plants to a new area in the garden. Try to get a high-quality seed source. If you're very concerned about bringing it in on seed, you have kind of a questionable source of seeds. We do have a technique where you can treat the seeds with hot water to get rid of these sorts of pathogens. There's a fact sheet called "How to Hot Water Treatment for Disease Management." It's available on my clinic website. That website address is pddc.wisc.edu. And if you go to the fact sheet section, you can find that. There will also be fact sheets on the two major bacterial diseases that we see on tomatoes. There's one called bacterial speck and one called bacterial spot. They're both basically managed the same way. But moving to a new area, using a high-quality seed source, good spacing, which will tend to dry things out, which makes the bacteria less active. But again, if you've got the spots on the fruits, I would not recommend eating those.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Chris. Turn to Mike and Viroqua next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I have a small evergreen tree. I think it's some kind of pine. And I say small, meaning it's like waist high.
Okay.
Just has a trunk, and then the branches all come out in one spot. And it was planted, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and it's done well until this year. About half of the needles have gone brown, and when I trimmed them off, I noticed that a lot of the little branches have some white stuff on them.
Is the white on the needles, or is it on the branches?
On the branches.
Hmm.
Does it look like maybe sap that has come out and dried? Kind of have a milky sort of white look?
Or is it like fluffy or gooey?
I wouldn't say it was gooey. I mean, I went in there, with some cutters and cut all the branches off, and I didn't get sticky.
Okay. And are the needles dead all the way to the tip of the branch?
Yes.
Okay.
Generally, it's like a whole branch at a time.
Okay. Then I think possibly you might be dealing with a disease called Diplodia shoot blight. It's one where it's a fungal disease again. It tends to come in through the branch tips through new needles and will infect, and then it can make its way down the branch and kill the branch off. We see this in Mugo pine, which is a smaller pine that kind of sounds like that might be what you have. And unfortunately, pruning is what I would recommend for it. There are fungicide treatments, but those are treatments you'd have to make every year. You have to protect any of the new growth that's coming out. If you're interested in doing that again, I suggest going to my website, the website I gave earlier. We do have a fact sheet on this particular disease. Oftentimes, though, I think the best bet is to consider replacement with some other type of evergreen shrub. Where we normally have real serious problems with this disease would be Mugo pine, red pine, and particularly Austrian pine. But other types of evergreens, occasionally I will see the disease, but it's not as serious a problem on those other types of evergreens.
You might also want to take a picture and shoot it to Brian at the lab.
Yeah, you're welcome to do that. And other folks can send photos
we can
as well. But
visually identify pathogen.
But you can email at pddc@wisc.edu. But given that it's a pine, that you're getting branch dieback, and that kind of white is probably dried sap that's come out of the branches, and that's pretty typical for this particular disease. But feel free to send me a photo, and I can take a look.
And actually, Mike, if you're at home and can shoot a couple of photos right now, one of the plant, maybe a little longer, so we can see the plant, and then a close-up, go to WPR.org, and you can email that, and maybe we can identify it right on the air.
Yeah.
Mike, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for calling. Our guests today, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at some late summer problems and threats in the garden and in sort of the lawn area as well with our two guests today, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston, who directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Open line at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jen emailed to ask if it's okay to hack or cut back her peonies now. They have the powdery mildew. Any way to prevent powdery mildew?
Quite frankly, I wouldn't do that. That's quite a cosmetic disease on peony, and they're still producing sugars through photosynthesis, even though they're covered with the powdery mildew, and I would leave those on as long as possible just to generate more food to store to generate buds for next year.
Yeah, that's right.
Just wait until they
too.
Frost yeah. off and then remove the material. In terms of management, it's hard to get away from that particular disease on peonies. Getting rid of the leaf litter will certainly help, and that's in general for other types of powdery mildews as well. Cleaning up, good fall cleanup. The unfortunate part is powdery mildew fungi and perennials also tend to overwinter in the overwintering buds. So it's kind of sitting there waiting to recolonize the plant next year. It is cosmetic. So really on something like peony, if they're blooming profusely and they look good in the early part of the summer, I personally wouldn't bother doing any sort of treatment. If you're interested in kind of a pseudo-organic treatment, there is a baking soda mix that you can mix up. Again, if you go to the website that I gave earlier and look up our powdery mildew fact sheets, there's a recipe for that. But again, I think that's kind of a waste of time and effort on peonies and on most plants for that matter, quite frankly.
Yeah, there you go. Let's go to Jim in Oshkosh next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question about apple trees. I've been growing apples for 12 years, and I thought I had it down to a science. But this year, the Honeycrisps and the Golden Delicious had zero blossoms. And I know there's up years and down years, but they had zero blossoms on them. Is that weather-related, you think?
Lisa, what do you think?
That would be my guess. We also in the Madison area have experienced some trees that really didn't produce many flowers. The flowers, the buds are produced the season before, so when we have something like a polar vortex, it's quite possible to get them killed off. And some varieties are going to be more susceptible than others. Also, if you had, I don't know whether you saw any buds like forming in the spring and then they fell off, or whether you just didn't see any at all.
They seem normal, but I did notice that the Macintosh, there was more blossoms on one side of the tree than the other, which was strange.
Yeah, is one side more shaded than the other or more exposed to wind than the other?
The western side gets afternoon sun and so forth, and no. So it's been a mystery. I just assumed it was weather.
Yeah, I would assume with the polar vortex that's probably what happened. We had, warmth in the winter, and then we had that precipitous temperature plunge, and it was back and forth, and that prolonged period of cold really knocked a lot of plants for a loop.
Yeah. There you go, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Ron in Whitefish Bay, it is your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. My daughter had to have a ash tree removed from her yard about 2 years ago, and now the city came and said that she has another one that has to be removed. Is this going to be a yearly thing with all the ash trees, or some of these really young saplings and everything? Should I just get rid of all of them right now?
Well, with ash, you have two choices. You can either treat them or you can take them down, basically. Those are your two choices, because the emerald ash borer is now so widespread that almost everybody is exposed. I'd say if you wanted to treat some of the older, larger ones, if they're still in good shape, bear in mind you would have to treat probably every 2 to 3 years, and an injectable product is what would be the best recommendation, although there are some granular soil applied products too. But yeah, those basically are your two options, unfortunately.
And what does it cost every 2 or 3 years, the injectable? Is it?
Well, it's going to be based on the caliper size of the tree, yeah, and the product that's used and the concentration of the product that's used. There is an organic injectable product that is based on neem oil that you have to do every year because it doesn't last very long in the tree. The ones that are based on emamectin benzoate or triage, that's usually every 2 or 3 years depending on the concentration and so on.
So if it's $100?
Oh, if it's a larger tree, it's going to be more than that. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to give any quotes because yeah, that'll get me in trouble with the industry. But usually they have a dollar price per caliper inch of the tree.
So then you have to divide by 2 or 3 to figure out how much is it costing me per year.
Right.
Yeah.
And we do have some fact sheets. There's one called, Is My Tree Worth Treating for Emerald Ash
Borer?
Yes,
that's a really good one.
On the website that I mentioned earlier, my clinic website. And then there's both a homeowner and professional guide to insecticides. I almost said fungicide treatments again. Insecticide treatments for emerald ash borer, and those are both on the website as well.
Also, the DNR, the state DNR website, has some really good information on EAB.
And your website is PDDC at
PDDC.wisc.edu.
PDDC.wisc.edu. Okay.
Yeah,
we should probably mention that from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Just go to the fact sheet section. There's a fact sheet tab, and then hover over that. Just select all from the drop-down menu. That gives you the entire alphabetical listing, and then you can scan down and look for the fact sheets you're interested in.
There you go, Ron. Thank you so much. Bill in Racine, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Say, 20 years ago, we bought a knockout rose and flowers it's still blooming that, but it had, you know, the leaves were attacked. So I picked up an ortho product, you know, to evidently alleviate that problem. So we bought another, we liked the knockout so much, we bought another one to put it in. So it's brand new this year. And I'm wondering, and the leaves are being attacked again, should I use this ortho product? You know, it's about 20 years old, seems to do the job on the old one. So what do you think?
Probably the efficacy on a 20-year-old product is not going to be
much.
The best.
And what's the feeding damage look like on the leaves?
Yeah, because if we don't know what we're treating.
Is it lacy or are the entire sections of the leaf gone?
Little sections are gone.
Is it like little round cutouts?
If you got a minute, I'll open a door and take a look.
Okay. Yeah, there is a leaf cutter bee, which is a pollinator species that we wouldn't want to treat, that makes these little like half moon kinds of cutouts usually on the edges of the leaves, whereas something like Japanese beetle tends to make the leaves look like lace. There are a plethora of other pests too that chew on rose leaves, but if it's the leaf cutter bee, I would definitely not spray.
Well, I'm looking at it right now. They're little round, it's a roundish, small, very small, maybe not even eighth of an inch circular.
Okay, that's not leaf cutter bee. Are the holes in the middle of the leaf or?
Kind of spread out.
Okay.
Well, a little bit. They're off of where the main stem would be. You know, you kind of see the stem coming down the center.
Yeah. Do any of the holes have what we call window painting, where there's like kind of a clear area of tissue, or are they holes all the way through?
No, it's a hole all the way through.
Okay. Ah, boy, that could
hard
be
to, hard to tell. And what percentage of the leaf surface do you think is affected?
Very small percentage.
In that case, I wouldn't bother. I think you're more likely to cause problems. You might kill off some beneficial insects.
And some bees that might be pollinating.
If it's that level of damage.
Okay.
So let her go, Bill, and we'll hope that everything turns out. I'm glad to hear that your knockout roses have been doing so well for 20 years. It's always been the case for everybody.
You know, it's kind of neat to have a Wisconsinite be the inventor of knockout roses and that they've done so well and all over the world, and it's very cool.
Yep, very cool. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it. Mary in Waukegan, Illinois. Hello, Mary.
Hi there. I have a question. I had some beautiful old irises that I planted in 1978, and in the space of a month this summer, they were decimated. So I took one of them to our extension service, and they said it was rubbed. Now, I know I've got to get rid of everything, but what am I going to do as far as the soil? Should I treat it with something? I mean, I'm afraid to plant anything there.
Were these kind of long, pinkish, worm-like creatures?
They're actually fat and white, and they have eaten the rhizomes.
Okay.
And they have little brown spots streaking up the leaves.
Okay. Usually what we have with iris borer is iris borer, which is this kind of long pinkish grub. Now, I don't know what it looks like in its earlier incarnations. It still was this actually in the rhizome?
Well, because it was like all of a sudden that almost everything was dead, as I was pulling the leaves off the rhizome. See, I thought maybe it was a disease because they were rotten, but
okay,
I
and that's one of them, the secondary.
I saw one of them with a hole, and in the hole was this little fat white. I mean, it was probably, I'd say, I didn't open up the rhizome and take a good look, but I think it was probably at least an inch long.
That's got to be iris borer.
Iris borer, for sure.
Yeah.
And the rot, Brian can tell you about, that's
a secondary. That comes in because there's a wound there. It's a bacterial rot, but it's really the iris borer you need to get under control.
Yeah, the adult lays its eggs on the foliage, and then, like you noticed, the little larva will hatch and bore its way into the leaf and tunnel all the way down into the rhizome where it gets larger and then eventually will come out of the rhizome and pupate and start the whole lovely cycle over again. It's very common, unfortunately, especially on the large bearded types of iris. If there are parts of the rhizome that are salvageable, you can cut off the diseased parts. You may want to use like a fungicide dust. I'll let Brian talk about that.
No, that wouldn't work because this is bacterial.
And I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's bacterial soft rot, isn't it? Well, okay. If you cut it off and you've got good solid tissue, you can let it dry for a couple of days and replant it. But if the whole rhizome is toast, then you probably would need to start over.
Would you put iris in there again?
Well, there may be some that are pupating in the soil around there, so I guess I would not use that exact area. I don't think I would treat the soil though with anything because I don't know how well that's going to work, but. We do have a very nice fact sheet on iris borer at Brian's website, pddc.wic.edu.
And you might go to some of the Japanese iris tend to not have as much of a problem. They don't have the big rhizomes like the
Siberian iris.
Siberian was, thank you.
The Japanese iris are a little bit harder to grow and need more of an acid soil. The Siberians are nice. They don't, the flower isn't as big and they don't bloom for as long. But yeah, it's a really hard one to control. There are some products that you can use as a preventative. You might want to check out the fact sheet that talks about those.
There you go, Mary. Sorry for that news, but good luck down the road. Appreciate it. Ruth in Abbotsford is up next. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I was wondering, we have infestation of Japanese beetles, and we've been using the water and soap and flick them into that off the flowers. but I was wondering if a Japanese beetle can harm any one of our trees.
Well, they certainly do enjoy feeding on birch leaves and linden. Those are probably two of their favorites. They also like hazelnuts. And
I've seen them on crab apples a little bit this year as well.
Yeah, crab apples. I've seen them on elm. Usually they are not going to cause enough damage unless it's a younger tree to warrant treatment. Now, there are some years when they're really bad where you might find that like the upper third or even upper half of a tree might be defoliated, but usually it happens late enough in the season that it's not going to really cause that much damage. But if you did have a younger tree that was being defoliated, then that might be
issue. Younger, you mean?
You know, one that's like 15 feet tall and doesn't have a whole lot of leaves to spare.
Right. Sure. Okay. All right. Does that help, Ruth?
Yes, it does. I was wondering if I could ask you another question.
Okay.
We have a crimson maple, and last night on one leaf, I noticed some kind of a grub-looking thing in a white tent. Is that something I have to worry about?
Tent caterpillar?
It might be. Yeah, those are earlier in the spring. It's probably forest tent caterpillar, is my, because PJ was talking about those this morning on our weekly horticulture update. Usually they are not going to cause enough issue, again, to be taken off. And it's too late in the season for gypsy moth, or should be. Well, wait, where's Abbotsford?
Marathon County, or in that region.
I don't know what the timing is on. I doubt, though, it would be gypsy moth caterpillars at this time of year. They're not white anyway. Did you see the caterpillar, actually, or just the...
I could actually see it through there, and I put it in a plastic bag and smashed it, and then I thought, oh, I should have taken a picture and sent it in.
That's
what
I was just
going to
ask
remember
you.
That for the next time. Oftentimes, the photos will help for ID.
Yeah, and then we can better advise you on what you need to do, if anything.
And was it just a single one, or did you see multiples?
All I could see is the one, but it was so gross looking that it kind of bummed me.
Yeah, well, sometimes they're a butterfly larvae, so you definitely want to take a picture before you smush.
There you go, Ruth. Thank you for calling. And David in West Dallas. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Hi. How you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I've got some variegated zebra grass that I've propagated and divided many times, and I put it in a spot now that I'm actually going to pour concrete. And it's late in the season. What is the best way to, I'd like to dig it up and save it, but if I do that and I put it like in a vegetable garden patch, is that advisable? I mean, will it live if I cut it down and then dig it up this time of year?
So the symptoms are...
No, he just wants to transplant.
You just want to transplant it. Okay. I was looking at your... it said, what's the best way to save decorative grass? And I thought it had a problem. Okay, yes, you can definitely still transplant at this time of year.
Yeah. Would you cut it all the way, cut it back? Or
I wouldn't.
I wouldn't either.
Maybe, you know, if it's like 3 feet tall, maybe cut it, you know, halfway just to make it a little bit easier to move. Yeah. But most of those grasses are pretty tough.
Yeah.
If it was a lot later in the year, I might not recommend it. If it's been dry in your area, I'd make sure to keep it watered.
There you go. Good luck, David. Thank you.
It should be okay.
Mary in Madison, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. It's a fun show today. I had a quick question about a river birch in my yard, if that's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've had this river birch. It's about 1.5 feet diameter at the base. It's our only shade tree, and it's been looking a little bit peaked for the last couple years, so I wanted to just run it by you quick.
Yeah.
So it's... lost one of its big leaders. We had an arborist cut that down a few years ago. And it's got, the leaves are all kind of a lighter paler yellow, and it looks almost like the veins are painted the normal darker color.
Yep.
And what's left is this kind of pale, sad looking leaf, and we're getting some dieback on some of the bigger branches. So I'm wondering if that's something that points to a particular pathology, or if I should get it, send some pictures in.
Yeah, is the bark white?
The bark is kind of that cobbled gray and flaking, and under it, it's white.
It's probably a river,
yeah,
birch.
It's a river birch.
Because with a dieback, I was wondering about bronze birch borer, but we usually see that on white birch rather than river. The leaf symptoms I can talk to you about, and this could be playing into the branch dieback as well. There's a problem that we see on birch trees. It can also occur on things like oak trees as well, particularly pin oak, called chlorosis. And in birch and pin oak, it tends to be an iron deficiency in the tree, but it's not necessarily because there isn't enough iron in the soil. It's usually because our soil pHs are very high, and that locks that iron in the soil in a form that can't be taken up by the tree. And the symptoms you described are classic. You get a lighter colored leaf. Sometimes it's light green. Sometimes it's bright yellow, but with those very distinctive green veins. So my recommendation, and it can get severe enough that that tissue in between the veins will actually turn brown and die. And in really severe cases, it can actually cause some branch dieback. So my recommendation would be to get a soil test done to check what the soil pH is. And then I'm sure it's probably going to be relatively high. We have a lot of limestone under our soils here in southern Wisconsin. That's what tends to make the soil pH very, very high. And then you're going to have to try to adjust the pH downward. But that's really going to depend on how high it is to begin with. If it's more than about 7.4, you're going to have difficulty doing that. And that's the situation where you might want to consider planting another tree in the vicinity of this birch as a replacement tree. So sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but that's a very, very common problem on birch.
Yeah, it is indeed.
Yeah, with river birch, particularly susceptible to that. So what the soil lab will do when you get the test and you tell them that you have a river birch, and they should be able to customize their recommendation for adding sulfur products to the soil to bring that pH down. It is not a fast process, and it is something that needs to be repeated on at least a yearly basis. But like Brian was saying, the amount will be dependent on what the actual pH is.
Yeah. And we do have a fact sheet called Reducing Soil pH, again, at my website, if you kind of want to read about the process. But again, you do need to have that soil test done to see where you're starting in order to get a sense of how bad it is and whether even trying to reduce the soil pH is going to be possible.
Does that help, Mary?
Yeah, so it sounds like it's not a pathology, meaning I could plop a tree near it and it won't be a danger to that new tree.
What I wouldn't put in would be a pin oak.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put in a red maple. Red maples have a similar problem. It's usually not iron that's the issue. It's manganese, but it's a similar mechanism. And definitely not anything like a rhododendron or an azalea. Blueberries you want to be careful with as well. Not that you're going to be planting those as trees, but all of those are potential. Particularly sensitive to these high soil pHs.
There you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we have Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the Department of Plant Pathology, UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, talking problems in the lawn and garden this time of the year with them. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And let's take another call. Brad in Saukville, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I'm calling because I'm having a little bit of an issue. I've got two sets of heirloom tomatoes growing. I've got San Marzanos or some San Marzano and some Cherokee Purples. I've been noticing on the San Marzano what I think to be bloom end rot. The bottom end of the tomato is rotted out. The rest of it looks fine. I'm trying to figure out, is there a way I can combat that without losing everything, or is that just done? And then also, is there a book for, like, solely tomatoes that you guys would recommend?
Okay. Well, we'll start with the blossom end rot first. That's classic blossom end rot. That is actually a calcium uptake problem. Now let's see. Sockville is where
Ozaukee
is
County.
Ozaukee County. So you're in clay soil. So usually, it depending on where you are in the state, if you're in sandy soils, it might mean that you indeed do have a calcium deficiency. Probably where you are, it's more of a water uptake problem. The calcium is dissolved in the water in the soil, and if you don't have consistent uptake of water, the cell walls, which have a large component of calcium, they can't keep up with that, and so they tend to degrade. So you get that blossom end rot. What you can do, the easiest thing, is to make sure that you're getting good, consistent moisture for good, consistent calcium uptake. You might want to get a soil test just to make sure that you don't have an issue with that. There are calcium sprays that you can use, particularly at this point in time where you already have the tomatoes developing. It's a little hard to correct the calcium problem fast enough, so you could use that. It is pretty common on Roma-type tomatoes, and you said you had San Marzano. So we don't, unfortunately, recommend using the tomatoes that are affected, but the other ones you could try a calcium spray on, and again, consistent watering. We have a nice fact sheet at Brian's website. Did I miss anything, Brian?
Nope. You added the calcium sprays, which I forgot when we had that question before. So that's a good thing to point out.
Yeah.
I usually like to tell folks to try to correct the problem before you need those, because that's a little bit of a pain to have to apply those. So if you can do the watering, particularly as the plants start to get into flowering and fruiting, nice, even watering and enough water.
There you go. And books, there's quite a few books out on tomatoes alone. There's one called Raising Godly Tomatoes. There's another one called Epic Tomatoes, How to Select and Grow All Varieties. So there's some other ones too. So there are a few books out there, Brad, and if you just go online and say books about growing tomatoes,
And there's also some seed companies that specialize in interesting tomato plants too. So you might want to do some searches on those.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Linda in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hello. I have three large Colorado blue spruce that have that fungal disease.
Rhizosphera needle cast.
Or Cytospora, I suppose.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry, Linda.
About a third of the tree is gone, the branches. So what is a good replacement tree to put in that'll be about the size of the Colorado blue spruce but are more hardy?
Yeah. Are you looking for that kind of look, or are you an evergreen? Or
yeah, an evergreen.
Okay.
A bigger tree.
A bigger one.
Yeah. Boy, it's hard because almost everyone that I could recommend, Brian's going to say, well, that one gets.
Yeah, sorry.
if it's white pine, that gets white pine blister rust. But we don't want to recommend Austrian pine, certainly.
Yeah, Norway spruce is one that seems, from my perspective, relatively disease free.
It does tend to get pretty darn big, but depending on how long you stay in the house, that might not be an issue. But as far as disease resistance and size, I guess that would be the first one that I'm thinking of.
What's your soil like? Is it heavy clay? Is it well drained?
It's pretty well drained. We're on a Drummond.
Then I might suggest maybe a white fir.
Oh, concolor fir?
Yeah, concolor fir would be another one. That's one that you have to be careful with the water, though, because if you don't water it enough, it tends to die from drought stress. If you overwater, it tends to get root rots. But if you've got a well-drained soil and are willing to water it a little bit if we're going to do a dry period, it has a coloring very similar to a Colorado blue and I think would be a nice tree for you.
Yeah, as long as it's not someplace where it gets a lot of winter wind, it does tend to be pretty prone to winter burns. So, that would be a nice one too.
And I would recommend not planting three of the same kind.
Yes.
Try to do different varieties. Where we see a lot of problems disease-wise is when everybody plants the same tree all over the place, and then these disease organisms come in and take out everything.
Yeah. I really like Serbian spruce, but it tends to be a smaller or less fast-growing tree. But that one is another one to consider.
So there are some options, Linda. Thank you so much for calling. Chuck in Prairie du Sac, your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Good morning. I have a similar question. My blue spruce is about 5 years old, and the growing tip died.
Okay.
Can I just cut that off, or is that part of the
infection? No, you can cut it off, but what you're going to need to do is basically create another leader. So one of the other branches that is nearby, you're going to want to kind of create a splint. Usually what people will do is they'll take a stout stick and tie it to the trunk where the leader would be, and you kind of tie that branch facing upward so that it will start to take the place of the leader. I know we have, I don't think we have any publications ourselves on it, but you might want to look up online creating a new conifer leader or evergreen leader. You want to be careful with that because if you tie it too tight, you know, you might end up girdling the stem, so you don't want to do that. But I have seen that kind of thing happen, like when a crow lands on it or something and breaks the branch, or any number of things that can cause that to happen. But you do need to, otherwise your tree will be kind of have a weird shape to it.
Yeah, really weird shape. Thank you very much, Chuck. And, you know, you can do it. It's not...
Yeah, it's
rocket
it's not
science.
Yeah, it's not all that difficult to do, but you might want to look up a picture so you can better see what the process is.
Nancy in East Troy, hello.
Oh, we have three apple trees, all different kinds. One is a Jonathan, the other one is a yellow delicious, and the third one is my favorite, a fireside, and. All of a sudden, we've been spraying them from early spring, and all of a sudden, the leaves are starting to dry, branches are drying off, and the apples themselves had like a reddish brown come appear on them around on one side.
Mm.
And someone who works with apples told us that we had a canker on one of the trees, which is like a collar rot, supposedly. And we're wondering, is there anything we can do to keep our trees?
Yeah, in terms of branch dieback on fruit trees, there are just an enormous number of things that potentially can cause that. This late in the season, it could very well be, I'm assuming you've had a fair amount of rain. Apples do tend to be relatively prone to root rots. So if you get a lot of destruction of the root system, that will lead to branch dieback because the trees just can't take up enough water. There might have been some lingering effects from cold injury over the wintertime. That can certainly be a problem. If you'd started to see the dieback closer to flowering, then fire blight, which is a bacterial disease, could be the cause of the issue. It's really hard to tell just based on your description what might be going on here. With some of these, you can prune out the dead branches, but with fire blight, you have to be very aggressive. That organism moves very quickly into the bark. So we tell folks with that one to prune down about 12 inches below where you see the edge of the dead area, and sometimes that will lead you back into the main trunk. If it's one of the fungal organisms that are actually infecting the branch and girdling it, then you can just prune down about 4 to 6 inches. But again, you have to kind of know what's causing the problem. If it's a root rot issue, that's going to be a lot tougher to deal with. And if you're seeing a lot of dieback on these trees and it is from a root rot, you may be better off planting new trees elsewhere. It may be very tough to get those back from the damage. Unfortunately, I can't say too much more about that without seeing some of the branches and also probably a root sample from the tree.
There you go. Thank you, Nancy, for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. We have an email from Kathy in Hillis and wondering if there's a red currant cultivar that's safe to plant in northern Wisconsin.
If you're anywhere near white pines, I would say probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah, even the resistant varieties still pose a potential threat for white pine blister rust, and that could lead to white pines dying in your area. So I would be a little bit cautious planting currants of any kind or gooseberries anywhere near where you have white pines.
And Marla wondered if there's a good book on Wisconsin woodland plants. She lives in central Wisconsin. Hmm. Anything off the top of your heads?
I can't think. I mean, I know there are a ton of good books out there. I don't have any particular titles. Our Arboretum here in Madison has a really nice gift shop that does carry a lot of different titles, but I don't know whether any of those are online.
Maybe good to just go to the Arboretum, UW Arboretum website, because those books are listed on the website.
Are they? Okay, that's what I was hoping.
I'm pretty sure they're listed on the website. Our guests today, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison, and also Lisa Johnson. Lisa is a UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Great to have them back. Certainly join in with your questions and comments. Love to hear from you. And many folks online, so I think we'll just go right back to the phones and take a call from David in Somerset. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thank you, guys. I had a quick question. I do maple syrup, and I recently moved into a new property and noticed that many of the mature maple trees that I was intending to tap were all dying at the top of their top of the foliage. It looked like it was all dead at the very top. And then some of the younger ones growing up as well look like they have the same kind of disease. When I go back in the farther in the property, none of the trees have that issue, but toward the front of the property, all of them do. I'm just curious, what do you think could possibly be happening with those trees? And they definitely are not producing enough sap as what the other ones would be doing.
Yeah, is it general dieback across the entire top of the tree for the most part, or is it individual sections of the tree that are just kind of totally dying back all the way back to the trunk?
Way at the top, and that's where it's kind of coming down, and then it looks like they're kind of getting hollow, maybe.
Okay.
When I cut a few of them down, they're like hollow in the middle.
Yeah, there could be usually that sort of response where you get a thinning of the canopy and the branch dieback is kind of a general stress reaction in the trees. And so if you were in an urban setting, I'd have you look for girdling roots, and I would have you do that anyway. So look at or slightly below the soil line for any roots that are growing around the trunk rather than outward from the trunk. Those can constrict the water conducting tissue inside the trunk as the trunk grows, and that will limit water uptake and movement up to the top of the canopy. You might have some wood rot fungi that are in there. Those can get in through wounds. I would expect eventually for you to see conchs, they're what we commonly call shelf fungi, that will form on the trunks of the tree. If you have those sorts of organisms in the trees, the other thing that can sometimes cause this general dieback would be a general root rot of some type. And if it's in a wetter area, that would be higher likelihood that that might be contributing to the problem. But there's some sort of stress on the tree. Unfortunately, I can't tell you too much more than that in specifically in terms of what might be going on. But those are some things to look at.
All right. I hope that helps, David. Thank you for calling. Therese in Green Bay, it's your turn.
Hello. I am fighting Japanese beetles, which is my first season doing this.
I used the row covers for a while, but I didn't know how long to actually keep those on. So now they're off. So it's roses. And there is an insecticide homemade application that's on the Old Farmer's Almanac. I just want to run it by you and ask you if you think this is a worthy thing to try. Teaspoon of dishwashing detergent, cup of vegetable oil, shake well. Add to a quart of water. Add one cup of rubbing alcohol, shake vigorously to emulsify. Then spray it on at 10-day intervals. It has a caution, and this is why I'm asking you. It says homemade sprays can run more risk of damaging plant leaves, so be careful.
Yeah.
Well, just to put it out there right away, we are not legally able to recommend anything that has not been blessed by the EPA as an insecticide, so we're not able to recommend homemade solutions. But what scared me about what you just were talking about was the alcohol, for one thing, because that can dry out the leaves. It also sounded really heavy in terms of the oil.
Yeah. And also the dish soap, oftentimes with dish soaps, they can have ingredients that are phytotoxic, so they will actually burn the leaf tissue. So I would be inclined to stay away from that.
And what can you do for it?
You could try neem oil. That is labeled as an insecticide, and it is organic. Unfortunately, with the Japanese beetles, because of their extremely long life cycle, because you know they're around for months and months, it means that you need to spray a lot. If you use something like a systemic product, it typically does not get translocated into the flowers. So if the flowers are what you're trying to protect, that doesn't work very well. It's just really hard with Japanese beetles when you've got a lot of them. Is this a fairly – you said it was your first year with them. The good news, unless you live near a golf course, is that usually – and I know this is 5 years down the road, but usually 5 to 7 years down the road, the population will start to level off. And I know it's really hard to find – plants that Japanese beetles won't feed on, too, since they have such a wide palate.
But they love roses.
Yeah, they
grapes.
Do love roses, grapes, birches, lindens, beans, the list goes, raspberries. What did I miss? there's a lot of things they like, hazelnuts.
And sometimes the best course of action is simply to flick them off into a bucket of water with some soap in
it. Yeah, that's what I usually tell people.
We'll take care of them.
Good luck, Therese. Thank you for calling. Michael in West Bend, your turn. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good afternoon. Great program as always. Thanks so much. Mm-hmm. My question is with regards to a planting in my yard which has a thornless cockspur hawthorn, which is a prolific flowerer and bears lots of fruit. However, right now, the side of my house and the fruit is all full of a burnt orange powder, and it looks like there are little spikes protruding, mm-hmm. Like a mace, if you will,
yes.
From all the berries. So I'm wondering what that is and what I can do.
This is a fungal disease called cedar quince rust. It's one of a group of diseases that are generically called the gymnosporangium rust because the fungus name is gymnosporangium. And there's a specific species called gymnosporangium clavipes, which is technically called cedar quince rust, but where I tend to see it is on the fruits of hawthorn. So it infects the fruits and causes those really spiny protrusions on the fruits. What's interesting is that this particular fungus and the other gymnosporangium rust fungi require two different hosts in order to complete their life cycle. So the spores that are being produced on your hawthorn fruit are not reinfecting your hawthorn. Those are spores that are going to travel over to some sort of juniper. And quite frankly, if you have red cedar, which is a type of juniper, that's a prime host, although this fungus will infect other types of junipers as well. With this particular variant of the fungus, with the other ones, you'll see galls that will form on the branches of the juniper. So there'll be these swollen brain-like structures. With this particular one, you just kind of see a swelling of the branch where the infection has occurred. And in the springtime, you'll get a little bit of oozing of orange sporulation out. And then there's a spore that's produced that will reinfect your hawthorns. The best control is to try to separate the two different hosts as far away from one another as possible. So get rid of your junipers if you're willing to do that. Unfortunately, in an urban setting, it's going to be difficult because you have to have them separated probably at least 100 feet, if not more. And oftentimes your neighbors will have junipers that will supply the spores for you. The good thing about this disease is it's not fatal. It just looks very, very weird, and it's causing some discoloration or some powdery material on the side of your house. So if you're willing to live with it, it's not going to kill your tree. Otherwise, you really need to either get rid of the junipers or the other. Well, as spray treatments really don't work for this particular disease, there really aren't any options. So the best thing is to live with it or get rid of your junipers.
There you go, Michael. Kind of pretty.
Yeah, it's one of the more colorful diseases, and actually there are leaf variants of this disease. There's cedar apple rust and cedar hawthorn rust, and I was at the state fair this week, and I took what I called my bouquet of pestilence with me, and I included branches from hawthorn with these bright yellow spots on a hawthorn leaves, and that's another variant of this particular disease.
There you go, Michael. Thank you for calling. Dennis in Deerfield, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. See, I've got something that's on my onion tops. Now, the onions are all mature. They're almost ready to pick. But last week, all of a sudden, it looks like as if something sprayed onto the tops, and there's like big brown spots where it's deteriorating. And I'm curious. I'm not worried about the onions. They're done. I'm curious about what that is.
Yeah, so it's actually on the leaves. Is that where you're seeing these spots?
Yeah.
There are several different fungi that potentially can infect onion leaves, so it could be one of those. And given that it's occurred this late in the season and your onions are pretty much developed, I wouldn't worry too much about that. Most of the time, these fungal leaf disease organisms, they really don't move into the bulbs typically. So I think you should be fine. But again, there's a fungus called Alternaria. There's a fungus called Stemphylium. And there's several other. There's a Cercospora as well that will go to onions. There's a downy mildew that will go to onions. And all of those sometimes can start out as discrete spots, but then will cause the entire leaf to collapse. So best thing to do, good fall cleanup, get rid of those tops as soon as you can. And you can compost those. You can bury them. You can burn them if that's an option for you.
There you go, Dennis. Thank you for calling. Rick in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Hello. Say, I've got a question regarding some fruit trees. I've got several brands of trees. I've got different types of apples, and I've got cherries and prunes, and I've got pears. And all these trees are planted within my yard, within 100, 150 yards of each other. Over the years, when they seem to get to be about 3 years old or so, they start developing in the bark between the ground and the first branches. They start to like rot there and break open. It starts like a vertical crack that breaks open, and then it can go all the way to the core of the tree. It does affect the tree, but geez, I've got some that half of the core of the tree is showing, but the tree is still, you know, producing some cherries and apples and so forth. So I've just been letting it go. And so this year I want to plant a few new trees, and I'm wondering if I've got a soil condition that could be causing that, or...
What side of the tree are these cracks on?
Let's see. I would say mostly the west.
Okay, I'm wondering about frost crack. We usually see those kind of on the south, maybe on the west side of the tree. These oftentimes form on trees that are stressed, and the biggest stress typically as a contributor is overly deep planting. So if you're going to put in new trees, make sure, one, you get a variety that's very cold hardy for your area. Definitely don't plant things that are designed to be grown in warmer climates. And then when you plant them, make sure what's called the root flare is exposed right above the soil line. So that's where the trunk widens to form the root system. If you bury that, that tends to put the tree under some stress. And then as the trunks freeze kind of cool and heat during the wintertime, that'll cause some stress in the bark that'll cause this crack to form. So you want to reduce any of those stresses. Also good fertility. So a soil test would probably be in order just to make sure you've got the right fertility for your fruit trees. And then good watering to get them established. And just good maintenance so they're not under stress as they go into the wintertime, I think will hopefully help you take care of some of this. If you have some exposure issues, you might set up like a barrier so that when the sun gets onto the bark, it doesn't shine right onto the bark, because that can heat, in the wintertime, can heat things up very, very quickly.
Yeah, especially with those thin bark.
With those thin bark trees. Yeah. So some stakes with like some burlap or something like that, just to kind of shade the trunks in the wintertime. I wouldn't wrap the trees. Trunks themselves, but just kind of a barrier to shade them a little bit in the winter.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling. I was thinking about one of my neighbors who lives a few blocks from me. I go by the house and I see the tree that they planted that they then mounded dirt on.
Yeah.
And I think, oh no. And so I've been hoping that one of them will be outside when I go by. Maybe I'm just going to have to go and knock on the door.
Yeah, and there are a lot of problems with that. A lot of street trees, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, the recommendation was to bury that root flare. So they are having problems right now. We see frost cracks and maples and oftentimes lindens as well.
Yeah.
Stephanie in Portage, hello.
Hi. How are you today? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a question. I'm trying to grow loofahs, and I didn't have much success this year. I'm wondering if there's something you guys can suggest for this area.
Portage area should be able to grow.
Should be able to grow them. What happened to the plants, if I may ask?
I started them from seed, and they never got bigger than, say, 2-3 leaves the most.
Oh, wow. When did you plant them?
Oh, probably early June.
Okay, so it wasn't too early.
No.
I wonder about the seed source. Were they older seeds?
Well, I got them from seedsnow.com.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with
that
source.
I'm not familiar with
that
source.
Did you dig up any of the plants at all?
No, I haven't. I planted them in a little pot, and then I put them in the ground after they started sprouting.
Did the pot that you used wasn't like a
peat pot or something?
Peat pot or something that you?
Yeah, it was the paper pot that you just sort of put them in and then it disintegrates.
Okay. Sometimes those don't disintegrate really well.
That was my thought when you said that. And so that may have inhibited the root formation of the plants so that they weren't able to produce a big enough root system for you to get additional growth.
Yeah.
I would dig them up and see if that little peat pot is still there or that little paper pot. And if it is, that may be part of your problem.
Yeah. There's the Wisconsin Gourd Society has some good information on its site. Actually, Terry Schmidt, who's called the Gourd Gal.
Yeah, she's awesome.
She's
a musician, too.
She's been on my show many times, and I've often talked with her about loofah. And so you might just go online to Terry Schmidt or the Gourd Gal or the Wisconsin Gourd Society, and there's probably there's a lot of information there on those sites. So something else to take a look at, Stephanie, and thank you so much for calling. Deborah and Brown Deer, hello.
Hello. We have a 40-year-old, maybe older, 40-foot-tall spruce tree that's completely dead now, but I heard this weird noise coming from it like about 2 months ago, and so I Googled it, and it came up pine bark beetle, and then I read all the comments people would say, now I know what that weird noise was, and I haven't heard anybody speaking about how devastating these pine bark beetles are. And I have to say, the white pines in the neighborhood and everywhere I go are the only ones that seem resistant and don't have any health problems.
Are there large holes in the trunk at all?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. That's probably pine sawyers. Those actually are a beetle that will attack trees that are under stress. They don't usually attack trees that are doing well in the first place. But they are quite large, and they do make a lot of noise. There are other beetles that can attack pine trees, such as Ips beetle, but those make little teeny tiny holes, and you'd never be able to hear them. But you might have had them come in first, or some other kind of stressor, like one of Brian's diseases that might have opened it up to attack by pine sawyers.
Or if you had a period where it was really, really dry, that can attract some of these insects. So yeah. Any sort of stressors on the trees, it's oftentimes these insects that are coming in and finishing the trees off, but they're not initiating the problem. So I would evaluate the trees for other problems and then see if there's any issues with how they're planted, how they've been watered, anything of that sort.
There you go.
It's actually dead now. So yeah. Now our issue is to have it removed, and two neighbors have had trees removed from theirs that were so close. They were in close proximity. They probably were affected also. But mm-hmm. How can I find one of the beetles to diagnose it?
Well, when they're taking the tree down, assuming there are any still there, you'll probably find some.
Yeah, you're going to.
They have long horns, and they're pretty big, a couple of inches.
Kind of hard to miss,
yeah.
Actually. So there you go, Deborah. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Anne emailed a photo of her 20-year-old pin oak. It recently showed browning and distortion on the new leaves, not the old leaves. Wondering if you knew what was going on there. It's a big tree, 30 feet high.
My first thought, although this, I can see the photo, and it doesn't look like classic symptoms of chlorosis, but the fact that the yellowing and the browning is at the tips of the branches makes me wonder if that may be part of the problem. And pin oaks are quite susceptible. We talked about this before. It's a soil pH-induced iron deficiency in the tree. Pin oaks are not a tree that I normally recommend for most people to plant in many areas in Wisconsin just because our soil pHs are too high. That's my first thought, given that the entire tree is kind of affected, but I can't say for certain.
And Sandy emailed some a hosta, very lush hosta that has showing some problems, smaller leaves and so forth. Anything that you can deduce from that photo?
Yeah, she mentioned that the root system looks fine, so that kind of rules out root rots. And also there's a nasty disease called southern blight. With that one, you would see little things that look like Osmocote pellets everywhere on the plants and on the mulch. So I don't think it's that. The other thing we talked about is possibly a viral infection that will oftentimes cause stunting. The most common one we see on hosta is Hostavirus X, although it could be another one. But I don't see any typical leaf symptoms on this particular variety. Check some of your other varieties, and if you see where kind of the color from the veins kind of bleeds out into the rest of the leaf, that would be a kind of typical symptom of Hostavirus X.
Also curious about whether all these hostas are in the same
right.
area.
If yeah. they are, that would be an indication of spread of some sort of disease-causing organism.
And on that happy note, we are out of time. I want to thank you both again for being with us, and we'll look forward to another visit. I've got to tell you, I did a little video ad with Nature Cat to promote Garden Expo coming up in February when the three of us will be together. So
very good.
Yay.
It's always a lot
of
fun.
Watch your local public television station for that. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison, our guests. They'll be back. We'll talk with them again. Lots of really good information there. Monday, time to talk technology. We'll take a look at some surge protectors and portable phone chargers, among other things. In the meantime, have a great weekend, but stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.